This cassette is sponsored by Rabbi Tzvi and Malki Shur in honor of the 50th wedding anniversary of Rabbi Daniel and Rebbetzin Shoshana Shur of University Heights, Ohio. May Hashem bless them with naches from their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren.
Familiar with what has become something of a legend in Jewish guilt. You know, how many Jewish mothers does it take to change a light bulb? It's okay, honey, I'll sit in the dark. And that happens to be one of the ways in which we generally relate to the concept of Jewish guilt. Guilt in general has been indicted by, at least in this century, by psychology in general. The attitude towards guilt has been that it's destructive, that it consumes direly needed psychic energy, that it's harmful. And then there are certain implications which come along with that, such as, you feel guilty? Who says you did anything wrong? And we could be talking about some fairly heinous kinds of acts. I remember once an article that appeared in one of the very earliest issues of Psychology Today, which was commenting on Carl Rogers' client-centered therapy, where the basic approach is one of accepting the client and approving of the client. What would Carl Rogers do with Hitler, Yimach Shemayim? How would he treat him? How could he be accepting of him? How could he address this person with his unqualified support approach? Nonetheless, the statement, who says you did anything wrong? By what standard do you hold yourself in such contempt, becomes a very, very meaningful kind of therapeutic tool, one which changes our attitude and our outlook on life. And somewhere we throw out the baby with the bathwater and we lose the concept of values, and with that, the concept of shame. Or an attitude which is a corollary to this, about which many, many volumes of psychological theory have been addressed, and that is the concept that man is an animal. Morris's treatment of the naked ape says that man is an animal. How can an animal feel guilty for whatever it does? Now, all of us accept the fact that there is such thing as legal guilt. Someone commits a crime, that society tries that person, finds them guilty, and then punishes them somehow in accordance with whatever the provisions of the law are, for someone who is found to have committed a reprehensible act, an act which the law deems is unlawful. That is a form of legal guilt. The guilt with which psychology has been so involved and consumed, the guilt which has been decried by psychology, the one that we don't feel real good about, is that kind of guilt in which deals with shame, a sense of ongoing embarrassment, self-contempt, self-deprecation, a constancy of a negative view, both on ourselves and everything that we do. This issue of self-deprecation, guilt which makes us feel as though we were unworthy, is one with which Judaism, classical Judaism, takes very strong issue. And we need to know, as we will be dealing with guilt in the next little bit of time, that we are not going to be allowing for the kind of guilt which leads to conclusions that there is something inherently evil about man, or that there is something that man can do which will completely compromise beyond redemption their integrity. And I'd like to quickly review for you some attitudes, educational philosophies which shaped much of the attitudes of the educational community in this country over the last century. One such attitude described human beings as an empty tablet, tabula rasa. And that somehow, on this empty canvas, which was every child when they're born, parents draw their pictures, extended family, neighborhood, community, culture, they draw their pictures. And out of the totality of all of the influences, there emerges a very unique kind of a person who is an admixture of all of these influences. And either those influences have been artistically correct and appropriate, or they have been destructive and they have disfigured and they have destroyed this innocent and clean slate. The opposite extreme argued that man was a noble savage, that every person is born an animal. Every person is really born much like all of those species which are subhuman. But unlike those subhuman species, there is something called socialization, in which we domesticate and we tame and we bring under control, we bring discipline to this noble savage as man is known. And I think that we can all see that those attitudes shaped much of what became the self-image of this century, a self-image which undermined people's self-respect. In either direction, people could not really respect themselves. They were either something born of the wild, which had been domesticated and disciplined by society, or else they were nothing, and they were the sum total of everybody else's well-meaning and sometimes misdirected efforts at creating something good. In contradistinction to both of those attitudes, attitudes, parenthetically, which when coupled with our own wrongdoing over a period of time, or the kind of criticism which we receive from the many people in our immediate surroundings as we grow to adulthood, there is little question but that if we are noble savages, everything that we do, by the way, this is not something that you spell out. It's not a philosophy or an ideology which is taught. This is an attitude. This is the way parents look at children. This is the way teachers look at their students. This is the way society views people. It's the way they get people to buy things with this attitude, and we pick it up by osmosis. We just absorb it through the pores of our skin. And we don't even know what it is that we are believing about ourselves, but these attitudes are kinds of attitudes with which we begin to think about ourselves. And the result of all of that is that when we do things which are in fact deserving of reproach, deserving of reprimand, they confirm for us, on the one hand, that perhaps we are indeed noble savages, but not so noble. Society has failed. The process of socialization is not really done well, and we see ourselves with the full condemnation of the fact that we are animals, that we are savages. Or else we say, all of this criticism, which we internalize, really confirms the fact that our parents, our extended families, the educational industry, they failed. And we're failures. After all, I was a white, completely clean slate. And now look at me. There's little doubt that those kinds of attitudes support the kind of guilt which is so destructive, which rots away and eviscerates the quality of our lives and the dignity with which we ought to see ourselves. And on the other hand, in contradistinction, the Torah tells us that neither of these attitudes is correct, but that there is something about a human being which sets them categorically apart from every other being in the universe. Man is not an animal. Man is someone who is shaped by the Almighty, who is invested with a soul which God breathed into him, which he blew into him from within himself, that man bears within him as his essence, an ineffable sacred spark which is godly, which is incorruptible. And under no circumstances, if people are privileged to send their children into the kind of educational system which sees children from this vantage point, or if someone is privileged enough to grow up in a home where parents see the child as a diamond, something extraordinarily precious, something divine and godly, and it's our business to see to it that it doesn't get ruined. It's our business to perhaps polish the soot from off the diamond so that the diamond can emerge with all of its brilliance and beauty, so that the task of the teacher is to convince the nightingale of its song, the waves of its crest, the sun of its rising, to convince a child that he is the bearer of that divine spark. When someone is raised, when someone is reared with that kind of view of themselves, they know that they have no right ever, even if they have strayed, even if they deserve to be reprimanded, even if they have done something which is contemptible. But they know that there is something inside of them which cannot be corrupted, that at any point, if they so chose, they could choose a future, a vision of greatness, of purity, an exalted kind of person at any time, if they but appealed to that precious innermost essence. So, as a beginning, if we approach life, if we approach ourselves with an authentic and classic Torah perspective and attitude, then we will know that the kind of guilt which is self-deprecating, the kind of guilt which turns us into people of despair, is unwarranted and unacceptable. And we can't view either ourselves or life itself from this perspective. The kinds of guilt which are in fact destructive and unwholesome, which are pathologic, are manifold. For one, we have that kind of guilt about which we just spoke. The kind of guilt wherein a person transforms the sense of wrongdoing into a commentary of character. I am evil. I am wretched. I am no good. Or in more contemporary terms and transactional analysis terms, I am not okay. We transform it into a statement, I am unworthy. It becomes descriptive of who we are. And that then consigns us to the garbage heap. That turns us into hopeless organisms. We have nothing really to aspire to. After all, we are evil and wretched and unworthy. There's a form of guilt in which we distort and exaggerate. There is wrongdoing. There is culpability. But there's something within us which makes it far worse than what it is. And we carry it to the kind of an extreme which again paralyzes us by the enormity of what we believe ourselves to have done. And that kind of guilt is destructive. There is the kind of guilt in which we hold ourselves responsible for things which we are not responsible for. And in a few minutes I'll give you a variation of this kind, but in particular over here, you can see this, for example, where young children whose parents are going through a divorce blame themselves for the divorce. They're not guilty. But somehow, because they said something, they took one of the parents' side, whatever, however it is, they believe themselves to be responsible for what transpires. And there are legion instances in which we take upon ourselves a fault of which we are not guilty. And that guilt is destructive. After the Holocaust, there were people who survived, who walked around feeling guilty that they survived. And they had no way, they really did, but they saw no way of redeeming themselves, of being able to convince themselves that there was a reason, a destiny for which they were spared. Instead, they wallowed in this self-consuming guilt, unable to take any pleasure in life, unable to find fulfillment because they felt guilty that their loved ones had perished and they were alive. I am certain that anybody who has counseled families knows that there's a form of guilt in which parents blame themselves for everything that goes wrong with their children. And they walk around with a guilt which they cannot disabuse, in which they cannot relieve themselves of. There's just this unrelenting pain. And that too is an unworkable and destructive guilt. And then, of course, you have some of these other things. You have this neurotic guilt, which many times results in certain forms of obsessive compulsive behavior. Shakespeare describes Lady Macbeth, who is constantly washing her hands in an attempt to rid herself of the stain of blood on her hands because she engineered the murder of one of the protagonists in Macbeth. And we have competitive guilt. Everybody who's grown up in a Jewish home, and perhaps in our competitive society, knows that how come you're not like Joey, and how come you're not like Shirley? And we are made to feel guilty by comparing, having ourselves compared with others who excel. Never mind the fact that they are endowed with certain forms of either intellectual or aesthetic genius, which we were not given. But we end up competing and feeling somehow guilty that we are not measuring up. And then there are people who inflict upon themselves their own inexcusably exaggerated demands. They hold themselves to some sort of a standard, which is completely unrealistic, and are never relieved of the guilt of not measuring up. There is a form of guilt in which, and particularly some of the earlier schools of therapy, such as psychoanalysis, played into, in which people tried to rationalize their behavior. The premise was, if we can engage in this dynamic approach to therapy, and we can introduce people to the sources of their behavior, they will then be able to take charge of their lives. And more often than not, as some of the contemporary psychotherapists, such as those the advocates of reality therapy, argued, more often than not, what it acted was as an excuse. People walked around saying, hey, listen, it's not my fault. This is what happened to me when I was an infant. These are the deleterious effects of having been arrested at a particular erotic stage. And the result is that I am hopelessly crippled and mutilated, and I'm not responsible for my behavior. And anybody who goes into a courtroom today sees how ludicrous are some of the forms of defense, legal defense, by arguing that that the people who created or who committed these terrible crimes were absolute mush, pieces of clay who were shaped by, and they had no control over their actions. There are some children who grow up in homes where, for whatever pathological reason, parents blame everything on them. And they internalize the fact that somehow they are responsible for everything that goes wrong in the world. And there are people who therefore become adults who are handicapped by virtue of the fact that they feel guilty for everything that goes wrong in any aspect which intersects with their lives. Finally, there is that form of guilt which comes as a result of low self-esteem. And it's the kind of paralyzing guilt. It stops people from living to the extent that people feel somehow inadequate, incompetent. Whenever they approach something, they say, I can't do this because I'm going to ruin it or I'm going to fail at it. And I cannot afford to visit upon myself the responsibility or the burden of guilt of having failed, so I won't do anything. So you have the guilt which comes out of doing nothing because to do something might invoke responsibility for it. Now let's hold that in contrast. All of these forms of pathologic guilt, and let's add to it Jewish guilt. Jewish guilt adds a dimension of the Jewish parent who has a vision of excellence which seems to be peculiar to Jews. Scholastic, professional excellence, that as Jews that we must excel, that as Jews that we must somehow be in the very top of every area of endeavor. And the result is that we end up with some aggravated kinds of expectations which really represent the level of excellence which the people whom we respect most, our parents, hold us to, which is a standard that really transcends our ability. And we're familiar with this business about Jewish guilt. How come you're not doing whatever it is? How come you're not making more money? How come you don't have more patience? How come whatever? And we have those parents who live vicariously through their children. And that was very true of many of the European Jews who immigrated to America or emigrated to America. And it was too late for them. But their children were going to. And they were going to live through their children. And so the children found themselves trying to deal with a level of living up to, whether it was a lifestyle or whether it was a career or whatever form of the many expressions of life, the parent wanted to live through the children, and the inability to really feel themselves competent in this particular area, because in many instances it just wasn't them, led to this Jewish guilt. We had failed our parents who had given so much of themselves to us. They supported us. And they were our biggest cheerleaders, and we failed them. And in reality, we were unfairly put upon by those who wanted to live vicariously through us. So all of these are really pathological guilt. And what's the alternative? The alternative is no guilt. A frame of reference with which we seem to have been bombarded a good deal. And there's an argument for no guilt. The argument may be based on the godlessness of a scientific community who emptied respectability from our hearts for religious expression and the spiritual pursuit, and the kinds of values which hold us accountable to a divine being. If there is no divine being, if there is no relationship between the infinite and ourselves, if there is no such thing as prophecy and revelation, if there is no such thing as a Torah law, then who are we accountable to? Ourselves. At best, society. In society, we are accountable to only so far as we cannot deceive them. There's a philosophic approach, because it has a great deal to bear on guilt. Dating back probably about 150 years or so, there came about a movement in thought in the scholarly community called existentialism. And basically, here was the argument. The argument is that in every case with which we're familiar, essence comes before existence. For example, a person thinks about a chair. So, we want a chair. The essence of a chair is something that can be sat upon. And so, because we want something to sit on, we begin to think about what kind of an item could we create? What kind of item could we build that will allow us to sit on it? And then we get a picture in our minds, and we proceed then to gather the materials and the tools, and we build this item, a table, a chair, whatever it is. Finally, we finish. We may spend many days, many weeks, many months, and we built what we thought about. What came into being at the end was what we thought about at the very beginning. Which means that the essence, the picture of this item was preceded by essence, and because there was an essence, there then was existence. And that's true of everything that mankind does. Essence precedes existence. There's a design, there's a plan, and the plan comes before we do something, which builds this thing, which makes this thing real. The human being, they argued, the human being has no essence. There's no such thing as a picture of what this person is supposed to be. Then what is he supposed to be? Whatever he makes of himself. Which means that when a child is born, that his existence comes first, and then as the child grows up and becomes an adult and begins to make decisions which define his life and his character, over the period of 70 or 80 or 90 years that this person lives, there is an ongoing definition and development which brings into existence an essence. So what came first? First came existence. And then at the end of the life, of this person's life, you say, well, now let's speculate, what was his essence? Is something called existentialistic philosophy, which saw a human being as having his existence come before his essence. Judaism, classic Torah Judaism, kind of brings both of these things together. It acknowledges that when somebody is born, that they proceed to define themselves over the course of their life. But they make one very important, one signal distinction. There is a picture. In the mind of the master of the world, the author of the cosmos, of the creator, there is a picture of what we can become if we were to maximize and bring all of our potential into reality. And if we were to do everything right, and we were to make all of the perfect decisions, we would become so optimally powerful and fulfilled that we would come to conform, eventually, to that picture which the Almighty entertained on our behalf. He looked at our neshama, he looked at our souls, and he said, you know what? I'm going to put you into this world. And I know that you're capable of all of these magnificent things. I know that you're capable of making of yourself something which is truly wondrous. There is so much grandeur, so much splendor in this soul. You can make of yourself something which is exalted. And he knows exactly, he knows, because he knows how, exactly what kind of strengths and what kind of capacities and what kind of potential are invested in this being. We may choose otherwise. And certainly, as far as we're concerned, we define ourselves over the course of a lifetime. But there is an essence which comes before us. So, in contrast to the existentialistic school, which argues there is no essence, we owe nothing to anyone, there is no image anywhere in the universe to which we ought to conform, there is no such thing as guilt. We're obligated to no one, we don't have to live up to anything. Whatever we make of ourselves, that's the way it is. The world is essentially left to the anarchy of our decisions, and whatever we do, that's what we are. That's right. And from that standpoint, we have something which is now going to replace all of the forms of sick and pathologic guilt, which were so widely denounced by the psychotherapeutic profession, and we're going to replace it now with a generation and a world in which there is no guilt. And Judaism comes along and says, not so. There is an ontological shame. There is an ontological embarrassment. There is something about every human being created in the image of his master, wherein if we do something unbecoming of us, if we do something which is beneath that divine investiture, something within us says to us, this doesn't resonate right, doesn't feel right. I am embarrassed, I feel ashamed. Or, if you will, I feel a sense of guilt. And that, my friends, is very healthy. It tells us that there is still tissue which is alive, which feels. That we are still responsive to something which is in our essence. And we know when it doesn't fit. And we know when we have just done violence to something, something magnificent and holy. Our own person and our own soul and our own future. Well-known story of the Hasidic luminary Reb Zisha. Certain that many of you have heard this story. Reb Zisha once told his Hasidim, he said, you know what? He said, I know that there will come a time when I will be summoned before the heavenly tribunal and they will say to me, Zisha, why weren't you like Abraham the patriarch? Why weren't you like Isaac or Jacob? Why weren't you like Moshe Rabbeinu, like Moses? Why weren't you like the great Hillel? And so on. He says, and in every instance, I know what I'll say. I'm not afraid. He said, but I dread the moment when the Almighty will speak to me from his throne of glory and will say to me, Zisha, my child, why weren't you Zisha? That kind of guilt is the kind of guilt which tells us that we are alive. That kind of guilt is healthy guilt. It's something which speaks to us and demands of us that we be responsive and alert and vigilant to something that is very real within inside of us. And we can tell whether or not we are acting out or participating in the destructive guilt or the constructive guilt. The destructive guilt cycles in the past. It constantly focuses us backwards. We are no good because we did this. We are worthy of contempt because we did this. The enormity of our wrongdoing constantly reminds us that we ought to despair. We're fixated on our past. Constructive guilt deals with the present and with the future. It says, this experience does not corrupt your soul, and there's something inside of you which allows you to rise to this challenge and to make whatever decisions you need to make to turn your life in a direction which will be life-giving, which will begin to maximize your potential, which will begin to address something very authentic inside of you. You can change course midstream. You can defy all of the Skinnerian thought. And you can make a free choice. You can exercise your free will. And every moment in life is a crossroads when we can do that, because there is something that we could not corrupt inside of us. And it concentrates on the now and on the future. And it says, yes, I know I did something, but that which I did is only all the more reason that I need to use my time from this point forward, positively, constructively, and emphatically and vigorously, claiming a bigger and better and more redemptive future. It's interesting that typical, of course, we've grown up in, we've been in conditioned now by 2,000 years of the diaspora, 2,000 years of exposure to, essentially, to Christian thought in the main. And Christian theology sees a human being as flawed, that a human being cannot escape his own iniquity, that he cannot save himself. Indeed, he is only liberated from iniquity by the fact that there is another force which intervenes on his behalf, which has died for his sins. Mankind is atoned for all of its wrongdoing by a single sacrifice in history. There is no dignity in finding our salvation through someone else's sacrifice. Judaism argues that the dignity of every human being is in drawing themselves up, ramrod straight in the presence of God and saying, God, you hold me responsible. You talk to me. Nobody is going to wear the mantle of my wrongdoing, and nobody will excuse it. Nobody will atone for it. I alone. Speak to me. I am the being that you created in your image. And I will own up to my wrongdoing. And I alone will toil to redeem myself. And so if we want to talk about Jewish guilt, we need to know that there are a couple of steps in dealing constructively with Jewish guilt. Not the Jewish mother guilt, and not certainly not all of those forms of guilt which are so distorted, but legitimate guilt, the kind of guilt which says, you have done something which was beneath your greatness. You've done something unbecoming of someone who wears upon their person, who bears upon their person the divine stamp. And step number one is a step which we really find articulated in this week's Sedra. This week's Torah portion deals with this most famous of all the sins, all the wrongdoing. Israel in its complicity with the golden calf, the idolatry. And after this terrible act, this act which has affected all of Jewish history, takes place, Moshe Rabbeinu goes back up to the mountain. Moses ascends to the mountain and says to God, "Ana chata ha'am hazeh. Please, God, this nation has sinned. Chata gedela, a very great sin. And they have made for themselves gods of gold." Now, that's not the way we would have written the script for a champion of Israel. To go up and make such a damning accusation. He's supposed to be our advocate. Find an excuse, find a rationalization. Try to talk about the fact that really it was only a fraction of a percent of the entire nation that were in fact guilty of this particular idolatrous act. That the rest of Israel were guilty of a far lesser offense. They didn't protest the wrongdoing. They didn't see in it something that was such an aggravated assault on the conscience of Israel. Yeah, say something in their defense. Be a public defender. That's what you're being paid for. Come talk about the fact that they were just in Egypt and they were slaves. Talk about the kinds of things that people talk about in court today. They were insane. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't do that. He comes up and he says, "I'm here to defend my people. You know what I'm going to say, God? Listen, what I'm going to say about my people. I'm going to say, Ana. I want you to listen. This nation has sinned. A grievous sin. A very great sin. And here's what they did." And that's the first step in dealing with whatever we've done. And that's to face it square. To own up to it. To acknowledge it. To confess to it. To say, you know what? This is what I did. No sense of pride, obviously. A good deal of shame, we would hope. But begin by extending. Don't hide behind anything. Don't try to minimize it any more than you have a right to exaggerate it. Make a statement which marks you as a person of conscience, a person of strength, a person who is willing to grapple with life. This is what I did. I went up to it. That's the start. The admission. That's the healthy beginning. That's where we begin to mend. That's assumption of responsibility, part one. That's Jewish guilt, which begins by our saying, "I am responsible." And the second is to begin to deal with the concept of regret. If not in heart and emotion, at least in our assessment, that we recognize that this is a wrongdoing for which we should feel profoundly remorseful. And then we need to go into what the medical profession would call etiology. We need to go into how did this unravel? How did it happen? Why were we vulnerable? Because if we don't take the trouble to understand how we got to where we were able to do what we did, then the chances are we're not going to be able to make the statement which will unlock us from Jewish guilt. And that is a statement of resolve. In order for us to be able to face the future with confidence and with courage, in order for us to be able to open a new chapter, in order for us to be able to look at ourselves square in the mirror and say, "I am a worthwhile and good individual. I am an individual of promise. I am an individual in whom there shines this divine spark. In order for us to be able to do that, we need to be able to come to terms with how we arrived at whatever point in our lives that allowed for what we admit to be a wrongdoing. And then, when we understand it, and we can take measures to protect ourselves against it, we can draw ourselves up and we can make a statement of resolve. Because I have something incorruptible, something sacred, something which cannot be defiled in my midst, namely a divine soul, I resolve that this will never happen again. I will not allow it to happen again. I understand how it happened, and it will not again be repeated. And then we can begin to deal with this concept of rectification. We begin to talk about what can we do, either to redress the wrong that we did, or to begin to do something so vigorously and so positively that we introduce into the world a compensatory presence that is at once redemptive and constructive in ways that are fueled by the fact that there is some anomaly, that there is some destruction of the fabric, the healthy fabric of the world because of us. And we need to compensate for that. That would be the kind of a response which would allow us as Jews to use guilt in a productive and constructive way. It's interesting. My oldest brother, Reb Shlaim of blessed memory, once made a very wonderful comment on an exchange, a dialogue which took place between the Almighty and the very first human being on the occasion of that human being's very first act of wrongdoing. Adam and Eve eat of the tree of knowledge in defiance of God's law. And then the Almighty comes to discuss the matter with them. And of course, Adam runs to hide behind some bushes because he is naked. And so the Pasuk tells us, and the Lord God called out to Adam and said to him, Adam, where are you? Ayeka, where are you, Adam? And Adam says, I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I am naked. And so I hid. And God says to him, Mihi gid lecha ki erimot? Who told you that you were naked? Did you eat of the tree which I had instructed you not to eat therefrom? And Adam says, that's the woman that you gave me. It's her fault. And my brother of blessed memory said, this is very typical when we deal with guilt in the wrong way. The Almighty took a look at Adam and said, you know what? He did something wrong. Fa-faun. He did something wrong. I've got to get him to look at the world and do something to redress the wrong. He's rent the fabric. He's torn it. He's polluted the world. Now, Adam, get up on your 2 feet. You're a powerful person. Do something about the world. Begin to rebuild the world that you've ruined. And so he comes to Adam and he says to him, Adam, Ayeka, Adam, where are you? Look around. Stop feeling sorry for yourself. You're busy with yourself, Adam. Rather than focusing on yourself, look at what needs to get done. And Adam doesn't take the hint. And so Adam says to him, well, I heard your voice and I was naked, so I hid. And the Almighty says to him, Adam, who's talking to you? I mean, we generally translate it to mean, who told you that you're naked? My brother said, that's not what he's saying. What he's saying to him is, who's discussing with you? Who's talking to you about your nakedness? I'm not interested in your self-pity. I'm interested in your acknowledging your wrongdoing. Let's start from there. Did you eat from the tree or didn't you eat from the tree? Look at what you did rather than wallowing in self-pity and trying to shore yourself up with excuses. And Adam still doesn't get the answer. And so he says, it's her fault. I'm gonna shore up my self-esteem by blaming somebody else. The liberation from guilt does not come by blaming our parents, blaming society. We will not be liberated or freed from our existential shame by perceiving ourselves or defining ourselves as animals. We will not excuse ourselves by displacing the reasons that we have done all of the things that we have done, nor will we successfully be able to get away with arguing that there are no values and there is no being to whom we are accountable with our souls. None of that will work. None of it will wash, because the reality of each one of us will not allow for it. There is a reality about us which we can no more deny than we can deny the rising sun of the morning or the very breath which animates our lives. Just who we are. And it will never sit square. There's only one thing that we can do to free us of guilt. And that is to own up. That is to feel a sense of shame. That there is something in this world which has been warped by virtue of the fact that we have committed a wrongdoing. Whatever that is. It may be years of wrongdoing. But we begin by a statement which says, I hold myself accountable. And to go through all of these steps which lead us to that last step in which we stand before the Almighty with our dignity intact, saying, I am responsible and I will dedicate my life and my future to realizing the vision of this exalted being that lives with my potential. And I will see to it in every which way possible to make the world a better world than that which I found, and that to whose ruin or whose diminution I contributed. That knowledge that we have stood at the fork in the road and that we have made a positive and constructive choice which acknowledges that inherent greatness is one which will from time to time remind us that we should be remorseful, that we should be embarrassed, and we should be ashamed of that which we knew better. But it will simultaneously exhort us to apply every possible strength and every determination and dedicate ourselves in every possible way to realizing that which can yet be ours. And that is a future which is bright, a future which is constructive, future which is exalted and noble and sublime. And it can be ours if we do that which some of the philosophers and some of the psychologists tell us we cannot do, and that is to choose. We know that we can choose, and we can choose to feel guilty. And that guilt, like the irritation of the oyster, will produce a pearl. And in the beauty of that pearl, we will recognize an excellence that will give us a sense of joy in being alive. And that's it.
For more information regarding cassettes, please call 1-800-878-5000.